This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of AtzidinWebYeshiva.org, continuing in the fourth chapter of the Rambam's Shmona Prakim. I hope that we'll be able to get through to the end of the fourth chapter today, and if not, we'll have to continue next time. The fourth chapter is, of course, the most important and most and lengthiest of the Shmona Prakim. And it's not surprising that we've dedicated quite a bit of time to it. It really encapsulates the whole major theme and message of the work. I'm sorry. I understand that there's some. Are we freezing up? Let me see if there's something else open here. Okay, I hope that I'm just trying to close down some other things that are running in the background. I hope that the sound quality is okay. The Rambam had been talking about asceticism and his great disdain for it, and a notion that we are meant to live in and of this physical world. I'm not talking ideologically. That's a different discussion in the Rambam about our engagement with general culture and general wisdom or secular wisdom. That's a completely different conversation, although it may not be surprising that the Rambam, the figure, the thinker, who had a positive, guarded yet positive attitude towards one, had a similar attitude towards another, when he thinks that we are meant to live in and of this physical world and to benefit from the pleasures of the world in which we live. Imki, however, with a certain amount, with a healthy amount of reserve and self-control and self-discipline, to be sure. But yet we are not ascetics. And I'll repeat what I said last time. Even though when you look at the history of Jewish life and thought, yes, you can find certain ascetic trends or movements within Judaism, but it was never the mainstream. It was never the mainstream. It's always important to talk, when you're talking about the history of Jewish culture, to say something is or isn't a Jewish a trait or attitude, to put in a caveat like that, because you'll always be able to point to some event which is the exception to the rule. But mainstream Jewish life throughout the millennia did not embrace asceticism, did not reject enjoying the pleasures of the world in which we live. Piggybacked to that idea, the Rambam now makes another point, which is why we love him so. V'im yavo ha'ish ha'sachal b'lo safek v'yishtadel lehosif al eile ha'dvarim kigon she'asar ha'achila v'shtiyah nosaf ha'mash nesar min ha'machlot. If a person, a foolish person, will come along and will endeavor to add on to the things which the Torah already forbids. The Rambam had said, why do you want to forbid things to yourself? The Torah forbids the things that need to be forbidden. Chazal, the rabbis, acting with the authority of the Torah, on occasion would expand Torah prohibitions, either as a corrective measure or as a protective measure, sometimes to the expression of the Mishnah in Avot, to build a fence around the Torah, because there's sometimes we need to make corrections, we need to make protections for various reasons, either because of the nature of a particular generation or the nature of particular times, or because, after all, even the Torah, which is broader than the sea and deeper, broader than the sky and deeper than the sea, can't actually spell out every single case. And there are things that the Torah does not forbid, because it again can't obviously spell out every single conceivable case. But yet, they're not right. That's very important on two planes. Number one, not everything which is permitted is right. And just because something does not constitute, technically constitute, a Torah prohibition, does that mean that you ought to do it? Part of the engagement with Judaism is to imbibe what the Rambam had called moral virtues, to understand that there are certain traits that are desired of us, and whether they're spelled out black on white in the Shulchan Aruch or not, you should understand what's wanted from you. So, for example, you know that Rabbeinu Gershom, that great Rishon, about 1,000 years ago, living in Europe, made various takanot. A takana is an enactment. A takana is an enactment. Let me put that on the board for you. Takana is an enactment, but from the same shoresh as tikkun, to repair something. You know, sometimes there's a loophole that has to be closed because even though something might technically be correct, even though something might technically be correct, that doesn't mean that you should do it. Rabbi Plavin points out that it seems that I'm talking about the general Torah idea of Lasot HaTov V'Yashar B'nei Hashem. That's correct. There are various, in the Torah itself, there are various meta-imperatives, which may or may not be counted amongst the 613. Lasot HaTov V'Yashar B'nei Hashem is a pasuk that says that one should do the good and the right or the straight in the eyes of God. That part of our job is to do what's right. In other words, beyond all the things that are listed out in the 613 commandments, the prohibitions and the positive commandments, you should do what's right. And understanding what's right and intuiting what's right is part of our job. Or as the Ramban famously described on a different meta-imperative of Kedoshim Tihiyu, in Vayikra, Leviticus, chapter 19 or 18? Kedoshim Tihiyu, 19. I have my handy reference work sitting next to me, my wife. In Leviticus 19, in Vayikra 19, at the beginning of Parshat Kedoshim, the Torah says you should be Kedoshim, you should be holy. That's a meta-imperative. That's something that describes the entire scope of the Torah. So the Ramban, Nachmanides, in his commentary there, points out that technically speaking, you could be a Naval Birshut HaTorah. You could be a degenerate. You could be a scoundrel. You could be a wagscallion. And technically still be within the boundaries of the Torah. You cannot violate any prohibitions and still get it completely wrong. And part of being holy, above and beyond technically not violating anything, is to get it right. So, for example, this is an example I started mentioning a few moments ago, Rabbeinu Gershom, one of the great Rishonim of the medieval period, lived about 1,000 years ago, makes various takanot, enactments. Among them, the most famous, of course, is his enactment that you can't have two wives. That you can't have two wives. That polygamy, although technically permitted by the Torah, and in fact, in the Torah, there are a few notable characters who have more than one wife, Yaakov Avinu, Jacob being one of them, that polygamy is prohibited. It's an interesting historical question. We've discussed it in some of our shiurim in the past. I don't remember exactly in which context. In the Jewish history, when we discussed Jewish history, when we talked about the Sanhedrin of Paris, Napoleon's quote unquote Sanhedrin, we discussed this because one of their statements had to do with polygamy, even though in Ashkenaz, at least in Europe, in Northern Europe at that time, Jews had not practiced polygamy for many, 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 many generations. Rabbeinu Gershom came along. Rabbeinu Gershom came along, and officially outlawed it. Another one of his prohibitions is that it's forbidden to read other people's mail or to read other people's, you know, private papers. Now, that's an interesting takana. And it's a rather tragic takana. Technically speaking, if you read someone else's private mail, you haven't violated anything in the Torah. But, I mean, Brian points out that there might be certain examples where it's called for to read someone else's mail, just like there are all types of prohibitions one can violate, even Torah prohibitions that one can violate under certain circumstances, such as saving a life that may fall within the category that Brian is talking about. Stacy, you can, if you have to go, you can, of course, catch the archives in the various ways the class is archived. When Rabbeinu Gershom made the takana about reading other people's mail, it was a really sad day. Because why in the world would he have to make such a takana? Why would he have to make such an edict? Anybody that knows anything about Judaism, about what the Torah wants from you, knows that you're not supposed to read other people's mail. It's just the wrong thing to do. Is it technically forbidden? Can you point to a pasuk someplace that says, don't do this? Is there a line in the Shulchan Aruch that says you can't do this? No, absolutely not. But, Rabbeinu Gershom, I'm being anachronistic there. The Shulchan Aruch, of course, comes 500 years after Rabbeinu Gershom, even more. But is there? Can you point to anything in the Gemara that says you can't do this? No. But anybody that knows anything about what God wants from us knows that you're not supposed to do this. So when you have to put black on white and make an edict to decree that this is forbidden, it's a rather sad thing. Because there are certain things that you should just understand. There are certain things that you should just know. You know, you can imagine, you know, a child who in a mischievous phase might do something. I'm thinking of a particular case. Let me just make sure nobody relevant is online with us. I'm thinking of a particular young man who, a few weeks before getting his driver's license, decided to take his father's car out for a spin, in the middle of the night, thinking nobody would notice. But of course, he got caught. So his parents say, you know, what were you thinking? So he says, oh, you never told me I couldn't do that. And their correct response is, we didn't imagine that we would have to tell you you can't do that. Chacham einav barosho. Just open your eyes. Think about it. There's certain things you should know on your own. You can't do that. It shouldn't have to be spelled out. The TLA, your case of a two-year-old is not a good example, because a two-year-old can't be expected to know. But somebody that has imbibed what the Torah is after should know that there are certain things that you should know not to do, but yet that's the way it is. So the Torah, the Rambam now is saying, let's go back to the Rambam. The Rambam is saying, the Torah forbids all the things that need to be forbidden. Chazal, with their authority, expanded them a bit. But we, regular folk, im yavo ha'ish ha'sachel, if a fool will come, and will endeavor to add on to the things that are already forbidden. Like he'll say certain things are forbidden to eat, or to drink, in addition to that which the Torah and Chazal already forbade. Or he'll take on certain stringencies about marital relations or relations between men and women above and beyond what the Torah prescribes. V'yitein kol kaspo la'aniyim o lehekdesh. Or, that's Brian, that's an example of Chazal. The case of dairy and poultry, that's Chazal, the sages of the Talmudic period, acting with the Gemara's, acting with the Torah's authority. The Rambam is talking about later generations, his generation and ours. V'yitein kol kaspo la'aniyim ol hekdesh. And a person will take all of his money and will give it all away. Another example of a stringency. You want to be right. The Torah mandates how much charity should be given, or it certainly makes very strong suggestions in the matter. But there are also limits on how much charity should be given. But if you want to take all of your wealth and give it to the poor, or dedicate it to the Beit HaMikdash, for example, or dedicate it to some other kind of holy cause, so that you yourself become impoverished. No safal masher haTorah min hatzdaka ve'hekdeshot ve'erachim, above and beyond what the system kind of allots for. Yeze ose maaseh hara. Really, you'll be doing something wrong. It looks like you're doing something righteous. You say the Torah says you can't eat these things. Well, I'm not going to eat anything. You say the Torah says you should give some of your money to charity. I'm going to give all of my money to charity. The Torah says that a husband and wife should refrain from marital relations at certain times. So you say, I'm going to refrain all the time. No, this is crazy. You're taking something you think you're being holier than thou, and it's not holy, and it's not good. It's wicked. You know, it's like, to use the Rambam's medical metaphor, doctor prescribes 20 milligrams of the medicine to make you well for whatever your illness is. So you say, if the doctor said 20 milligrams, I'm going to take 50 milligrams. So it's not only stupid, it's bad. 20 milligrams is what's going to heal you. 40 milligrams isn't going to heal you twice as fast. It's going to end up making you sick. It's a complete misunderstanding of how medicine works. Vahu lo yeda vayagia el hakatse ha'echad. And what will happen is, going back to the theme that he's developed throughout the chapter of the spectrum, instead of finding balance in the middle, you'll become an extremist. And the scales, or the teeter-totter, the visual metaphor that we've been playing with all these weeks, will tip, will go out of balance, will go out of whack. V'yetse min ha-mitzua l'gamrei. And it'll go completely out of equilibrium. ולחכמים בזה העניין דבר לא ראיתי מעולם נפלא ממנו והוא בגמרא דברי מערבה בתשעה דנדרים. This is the Gemara in Masechet Devarim. He quotes the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Ma'arava, in Masechet Nedarim, that says, Dibru bignut otam hamikablim al atzmam shvuot unedarim. There is a practice called a shvu'ah, which is an oath, or a neder, which is a vow. Somebody can take a neder, can take a neder, a vow of all types of things, in which he makes a promise where he accepts upon himself to do certain things. So Chazal forbade doing this excessively, because you could take vows until you're literally like a prisoner, where you can't do anything, and that's not what the Torah wants from you. So Rav Adi b'shem Rav Yitzchak said, "Lo dayach mash asra lecha Torah." Isn't it enough what the Torah already forbade you? Ela shata oser alecha dvarim acherim, that you have to add other prohibitions? V'zehu enyan asher zachru b'shaveh, b'lo tosefet b'lo chisaron. Not too much, not too little, in the middle. That's the way to go, says the Rambam. Balance, equilibrium. That is, of course, the Maimonidean way. Goldilocks, I don't know. There's some discussion in the chat about the Sermon on the Mount, which is beyond my area of expertise, but I'm sure that there's some relevancy to that as an example of what's gone wrong. This idea, of course, is so relevant in our day and age, when chumrazatzia, taking on stringencies, has taken over and has in some ways twisted what halacha is really about. Now, this is not to say, and we should be careful, not every comportation not every comportation with halacha is a chumrah, is a stringency. There are certain things, even in the last number of generations, or even in the last number of decades, there were certain things that even for observant people were not in fashion. Now, this may have been for all types of sociological reasons, including the very real difficulty of maintaining an observant lifestyle, a Jewishly committed lifestyle, regardless of what denomination you may be. It was difficult all around. Take the example in America in the earlier parts of the 20th century, when Marshall Sklar, the sociologist, predicted in the late 1950s, I think, a quick Google search will find the correct specific date, when he predicted that in a generation there would be no more Orthodox Jews in the United States. And he said that not as a wish, but as a prediction about which he felt sorrow. But speaking as a sociologist, speaking as a social scientist, he said this was the prediction. It was a very reasonable prediction. It was a very reasonable prediction indeed, because that's certainly the way it looked like things were going. The renaissance of Jewish observance in the 20th century, in the second half of the 20th century, is nothing less than miraculous. My description of what's going on in Poland today, 10 times so. But even in the United States, the idea that Rav Moshe Feinstein writes a tshuva in the 1950s, where he says it's obvious that if somebody's working in an office as an accountant or as a lawyer, it's reasonable that they wouldn't wear a kippah to work. He didn't recommend it. He didn't think it was something to be happy about, but it was certainly reasonable that people in the workplace didn't wear yarmulkes to work. Now, today, that's certainly true still for some people, but in America, on prime time television, you can have sitcoms where characters are wearing yarmulkes, just as a, not because they're playing the role of a rabbi, but just because in passing they happen to be wearing yarmulkes. In the United States, we have a few people from Connecticut with us, and you can express your opinions about your retiring senator. You could have a candidate for the vice presidency who self-identifies as an observant Jew. So there's been a sea change in the ability to be lead a committed Jewish life. So there have been so many changes. Not every conforming with halacha is A chumrah is a stringency. There are certain halachot that people were either not careful with or were unable to be careful with in the prior generations, and there's been a lot of improvement in that room. And that doesn't mean that that's a chumrah. It means that people are now coming into line with the mainstream halachic demands. That being said, there's still a lot of room for stringencies and sometimes extreme stringencies, which the Rambam is here arguing against. Brian asks about the source in the Torah for kippot, for wearing, for covering your head. There is no source in the Torah for kippot. It's a post-biblical, practice, possibly even just a very ancient minhag custom that Jewish men cover their head, certainly when they're praying and or reciting blessings or other things. And I'm sure a quick Google search will show you the history. If you search history of kippah or history of yarmulke, you'll find plenty of sources. And if not, I'll be happy to send some more on that. But the Rambam's point here in this one very evocative paragraph is to make that argument that just like you have to be in the middle, and you can't be, we wouldn't want anyone to be cavalier and excessively casual and uncommitted to their religious obligations. At the same time, we don't want you to become a fanatic. That the challenge is to be in the middle. No, Leia, these are two different ideas. There is this notion of saying 100 brachot a day, that the formula Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, fill in the blank, that one should say 100 brachot a day, which basically we do. If one davens certainly three times a day, and you eat something now and again, which we tend to do, so it turns out that all of that covers 100 brachot a day. There's a notion, I think Gemara mentions that it may have come from David HaMelech, King David, to say 100 brachot a day, that there's some, it's a meritorious practice. That's unconnected to the idea of covering your head. Yes, no, so it's true. And at a certain point, a yarmulke became the uniform, the identifying uniform of the observant Jew or of the committed Jew. But let's get off the topic of yarmulke. The Rambam goes on. Hine kfar hitba'er mikol ma she shezcharnuhu bezeh haperek sheru'i lechaven et hapu'lot hamimutzot ושאין לצאת מהן אלא קצה משני קצוות, אלא על צד הרפואה והעמידה כנגד בהפך. Here he is really summarizing and repeating what he said before, that the work of lechaven, the example I've kept been giving of the old television that had the tune and the fine tune, that you, this balancing act, a few times I perhaps casually referred to it as that picture in the Cat in the Hat picture. I once posted it up, here. I'll put it in the chat again. I wasn't trying to be cute about it, but that idea of the balancing act of the almost impossible, keeping it all up in the air while bouncing on the ball with the rake and the fish and the cake and the books and that's the without the clownish component to it. That's what the Rambam is suggesting, that all of your midot, all of your personality traits have to be balanced and fine tuned. And I've mentioned this idea before, that the Rambam talks about each personality trait as discrete entities, but it seems to me obvious that he understands that we are the conglomeration of many, many, many different personality traits, many different midot, and that they interact in a very, very delicate way on each other, so that, you know, like if you pull the thread of a tapestry, it's liable to start unwinding the whole thing. Or if you know, lahavdil, if you drill the hole under one seat in a boat, everybody's liable to sink. If there's something wrong with one of your midot, one of your characteristics, it's liable to throw everything out of balance. And that constant vigilant work of keeping it all fine-tuned so that the seesaw or the scales don't go out of balance, don't go out of whack, that's the work of deot, that's the work of personality development. I'll skip ahead just a bit. Chen Adam HaShalem, the perfect person, or the person who is striving or aspiring towards perfection, Ru'oi lo shivaker midotav tamid. It is appropriate that he should, yivaker means to visit, like bikur cholim, but yivaker means also to audit. If you get audited by the Mas Hachnasa, by the Israeli IRS, it's called a bikoret, because they make a visit of your bank account. So you should audit your traits constantly. V'yishkol pu'lotav, you should weigh your actions. V'yivchon tchunotav nafsho yom yom, a daily basis. This becomes the practice later of the Musar movement. This becomes the practice of the Musar movement of keeping some type of spiritual journal or diary where you take a daily accounting of your growth, of your strengths, of your weaknesses, physical, spiritual, mental, emotional. It becomes a very hard, laborious task. V'chol shir nafsho noteh lekatzeh min hakatzavot yimaher beripui. And as soon as you see that something is going out of whack, is going out of balance, you should very quickly attempt ripui. You should try to heal it. You should try to remedy it. V'lo yaniach tchunatav hara'ot lehitchazek bekfilut po'al hara kemo shezecharnu. And you shouldn't let it, something starts going wrong, you can't let it slide. If you see that you're feeling, let's take the example of anger, which for the Rambam is always a particularly dangerous attribute because it's such a powerful emotion. So if you see you're slipping into anger, don't say, well, that's something I'm going to have to take care of, I'll have to take care of. No, you have to nip it in the bud. Brian points out that this does sound like certain things in 12-step programs. In the past, I've mentioned that there are certainly, not to turn the Rambam into a 12-step program, but there are certain truths in that type of work, that type of reparative work, particularly, let's say, Alcoholics Anonymous, but other things as well, which certainly resonate with what the Rambam is saying, although not 100%. V'chein yasim lenegad einav hamida ha'pchuta shelo v'yishtodeh lerfua tamid lerapa tamid kemo shehigdamnu. So that's what the Rambam says. You have to work hard to fix it, because a little bit of problem, a little bit of falling out, it will snowball. To take the example, again, the visual metaphor of the scales, which the Rambam also uses to great effect in Hilchot Tshuva, in the Laws of Repentance. There, the Rambam famously said that when it comes time for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you should imagine that the scales of justice, the scales of judgment rather, not justice, the scales of judgment are equally balanced. that you're 50% righteous, 50% wicked, or 50% meritorious, and 50% you have some things that you're going into the judgment with that, you'd rather not have. And any act that you do has the potential, lahachriya kaf, to tip the scales, that the mildest positive action, or God forbid, the mildest negative action, not even a full-blown sin, just something that's a little bit wrong, the weight of a feather could tip the scales. And then the Rambam really piles it on. He says, when we're judging you on Rosh Hashanah, we're not just judging you, we're judging the whole world. And you have to imagine that the whole world is 50-50. And if you tilt your scales with the weight of a feather, that will then carry the whole world along with you, either lechav zchut or lechav chovah, either for merit or for punishment. So the Rambam says that's the kind of work you have to do, the sensitivity that you have to have for even minor personality defects. Having said that, he now brings perhaps the most famous example of a minor flaw, a seemingly minor flaw, certainly when judged on the canvas of a larger life, where that one w almost weight of a feather, or a feather and a half, when judged against the merits of the person under discussion, is enough to tilt the scales in a bad direction. And this, of course, is the famous example of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu. Vatayodeya, ki Adon harishonim vaachronim, the master, the first and the last, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our teacher, kfar amar lo yitala, ya'an lo he'emantem bi, because you didn't he'emantem, because you didn't literally, you didn't believe in me, although Chazal are very careful to point out that that's probably not what the verse is talking about, that Moses did something, in this case, perhaps hitting the rock. Famously, the famous example, they're in the desert in Bamidbar chapter 20, Book of Numbers chapter 20. They're in the desert. The people don't have water. They've taken up to complaining quite a bit. God says, Moses says to God, what am I going to do? Where am I going to get the water? God says, strike the rock. Speak to the rock, rather. The rock will give forth water. Moses strikes the rock, and water comes forth. And this somehow is very problematic. And this is somehow very problematic. Why is it problematic? What was Moshe's sin? What did he do wrong? It's not clear. I think someone famously said that Moses did one sin. His whole life he did one sin. And the Mefarshim, the commentators, by the time they were done, turned it into a dozen sins. Because it's so enigmatic exactly what happens in the story and what he did wrong and why, because of this, his punishment is that he can't enter the land, that he has to die in the desert with that whole generation, and Moshe Rabbeinu, who brought us out from slavery to freedom and led us in the desert and taught us the Torah, that he's punished. He can't see the promised land because of this sin. What exactly was it? So every single commentator, from the earlier commentators to the latter commentators, every single one tries to explain what it is that the Rambam did wrong. Rashi, no, so Barbara points out that he showed anger. That's what the Rambam is saying here. But everybody else says something else. Rashi says the problem is that God said, speak to the rock, and Moshe hit the rock, and that lessened the miracle. The Ramban asks on Rashi, I don't know, getting rock out of the water by hitting it seems like a pretty big miracle to me. I don't see how that's lessening the miracle any. And every one of the other commentators, if you look in the volume by Nechama Leibovitz, the great almost contemporary scholar Nechama Leibovitz, she spells out in painstaking detail a survey of all of the opinions of the Rishonim, of the medieval authorities, on how to interpret it. And you'll see that there's almost no limit to ways to explain it. But the Rambam understands it in the following way. Al asher meritem, al asher lo kidashtem, kol zeh vechet'o alav ha-shalom haya shenata el echad mishnei ha-ktzavot b'ma'ala mi'ma'alat ha-midot. As Barbara points out, the Rambam says that Moshe's sin was that he deviated from the central path ever so slightly. I mean, did Moshe go into a whirling dervish? Did he turn red and salivate at the mouth and scream and jump up and down? No. He said something that somehow may have been harsh. He spoke in some kind of harsh way. Vehi hasavlanut ka'asher nata el hakas. Regarding the matter of savlanut, of patience, of forbearance, he erred slightly, nata. He inclined, he tipped a bit regarding anger. Ba'amro shim'u na ha'morim. Shimu na ha'morim. Moshe said, Bamidbar Kaf Yud, Book of Numbers, Chapter 20, Verse 10. Shimu na ha'morim. He says to the people, listen up, you rebellious folk, you angry people. When I was a teacher in a high school, the principal used to like think it was funny to say to the teachers, Shimu na ha-morim, because morim can also be teachers. But here it means something else. Here it's like mordim, it's like rebels. Dikdek Hashem alav shiyeh ish kemohu ko'es bifnei kal Yisrael. God was exacting with him, because Moshe, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Someone like him, a prophet, chief of all prophets, leader, bringer of the Torah, closest to God, he is judged on an even higher scale. And he can't show any anger in front of the people. B'makom she'en ro'oi bo kas. Because it's not appropriate to be angry. After all, God wasn't angry at the people. God must have thought it was a reasonable thing that they should want water. Right? It wasn't, you know, this is also true in parenting so often. So there's so many metaphors here to good parenting. Maybe one day I'll try to spin this around to like one of those parenting seminars that are so popular, because, you know, parents are always a little desperate for some good advice, because when you're in the thick of parenting, particularly when you have younger children, I think, I don't know, those of you that have much older children can probably tell me that it's true then also, but like, you know, sometimes you feel that you're lost at sea and you'll cling to anything. You know, so everybody's always interested. If somebody thinks, like everybody can set up their own soapbox. If somebody thinks that they, you know, if people think that someone has some secret advice about parenting, they'll pay money to go hear it. So, you know, maybe I'll do that one day. But this is also true in parenting. You know, sometimes your kids do something and like my mother always used to say, it's not what you say, but how you say it. So, I don't know, like imagine you're on a long car ride. The metaphor should be clear. Long car ride, 40 years in the desert. You're on a long car ride, and it's hot, and it's late, and you got lost along the way so that it's, you're not there yet. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? The kids haven't eaten in a while, and little kids, they need to eat, or they need to drink, or they need to go to the bathroom. These are all reasonable things. So, the kids say, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I have to go to the bathroom. So the father says, don't make me turn this car around. Right? One more word out of you. You know what? Those are all reasonable requests. Maybe because of the circumstances, there's like an element of kvetch to it. So it's always important as a parent to like differentiate between what they say and how they say it. When my mother used to say, it's not just what you say, it's how you say it, that's a good lesson for someone to learn. Because often we're judged by how we say it and not just what we say. But when you're the leader, when you're Moshe Rabbeinu, or even when you're a parent, it's not just how they say it, it's also what they say. And God says, they're kvetching because they want water. Well, it's pretty hot in the desert. It's not an unreasonable request. Let's try to get them some water. So Moshe's mistake was to confuse the medium and the message, and to think that because they complained wanting water, a reasonable request, proof of the fact that it's a reasonable request is God himself basically admits that it's a reasonable request. Moshe's punished because his anger on what they said. On how they said it, when in fact what they said was a reasonable type of thing and should be graded on a curve. So that the Rambam says is the problem with Moshe, because he ever so slightly got angry. Now, why is this such a terrible sin? So we'll come back to this. This is an essential point, even though it's presented here as a parenthetical point. It's an essential point that ends the section. We're very, very, very near the end of the fourth chapter. There's just another paragraph and a half. I hope next time we'll finish the fourth chapter. I'd hope to finish it tonight. I had posted to the page, to the class homepage, this nice little article that discusses the issue unto itself of Moshe hitting the rock, and I recommend that to you. It's by my friend Rabbi Natty Helfgott. I recommend that to you for your own reading, if that interests you. And next week we'll continue with the discussion of what's going on here with Moshe, and we'll finish up the fourth chapter, and maybe even we'll begin the fifth chapter, which is itself also somewhat parenthetical. I will stay on if people have any questions, and or let me just check in the chat to see if there was anything else.